Jeff, and this is My World. This podcast is about getting to know my friends better by reading a book with them and discussing it. Some of these friends read a lot, some read a little, and some, honestly, I'm not sure can read, but we'll find out, that's for sure. Today's guest reader is Patrick. We've met through Gamer Friends almost a year ago, and he also went with me when I saw my first Sondheim performance, The Company, live here in Boston. Say hi, Patrick.
Hello.
So today we are going to discuss The Handmaid's Tale. You actually reached out to me when I were... What were we talking about?
I don't remember.
It was either on Facebook or Twitter. Josh and I had been planning this. Not really planning this. Josh gave me the idea for it, and I started scheming, and you were like, oh, hey, I would totally do that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know what it is, but I would totally do it. And, like, you had no idea what it was. And then I sort of was able to flesh out the idea a little bit further, and I sort of knew I wanted to talk about... to pick a book and read it with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, all right, I need to start filling the episodes. And I was like, hey, Patrick, you said you were interested. Do you want to do it? So what were you expecting?
Well, I was expecting something about books. I didn't know which books, but you gave me a list. And I wanted to read Twilight, but that one was taken.
Yes, that's... Allie will appreciate that. My best friend growing up wants me to read that book. And I have been avoiding it for years, and you can see it's over there. I refuse to give her any money.
I read the first page a while ago, and I was like, this is ridiculous, and then put it down.
That's going to be a challenge.
Maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, I'm reading Dracula right now, so I'm like, oh, maybe that means I'll have to read that soon, because I can be like, awesome vampire book and Twilight. But yeah, and then there were a couple of other ones that you suggested. And I know one you really wanted to read that I have no desire to read.
House of Leaves?
House of Leaves.
Yeah. Speaking of, I started actually making a interactive fiction game based on House of Leaves.
Oh, that's right. You were telling me about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. I've flipped through it once, and I had no idea what... I don't do well with, like, postmodern poems or really artwork or anything of that sort. I'm not a fan of contemporary art. I'm just kind of like...
ergodic literature?
Yeah, no. I mean, the book is beautiful, the bound and, like, flipping through it. It's absolutely stunning, but, like, I don't think I could follow anything inside of the book. But that's really cool. What's the game like? Is it just sort of... is it the labyrinth?
Yeah, so it's interactive fiction, so you see just a bunch of text describing what's going on. You can type commands into it, like, go west, go north, take a picture. But it's supposed to be just the exploration of the labyrinth inside the house. The cool thing about it that I was really excited, like, the whole point I wanted to work on this was I wanted to make it procedurally generated.
Okay.
So each time you step into a room, it creates a new room on the fly in, like, a random direction. So every time you play the game, it would be a whole new labyrinth to explore.
Oh, wow. Okay, so if you're listening and you haven't figured it out yet, Patrick does weird, awesome things with games. Are you an actual game designer?
Yes.
Okay. It's like, you're an engineer. I was like, you're an engineer of some sort. You went to MIT. You're one of those smart people.
No, I graduated from MIT with a humanities degree. I'm actually a game designer and not really an engineer.
Okay, I didn't know you were humanities. That's even cooler. But that's what you do professionally. You do game design.
Yeah.
And you do educational software/games?
Yeah. Doing
that?
Yeah, I work for Muzzy Lane up on the North Shore. We make educational games.
Nice.
Currently working on a Spanish learning game for McGraw-Hill.
I've seen that. That actually looks really cool. But I do have to admit, the coolest thing that you do, and I was going to save this till the very end, but we have to talk about it right now, are the bots that you create. Which is the Twitter that is all of the bots that you have? You have a list. What's it called?
If you go to my Twitter page, which is twitter.com/lightaesthetic, you can see, like, look up my lists, and then the list is called My Bots.
My Bots, that's okay.
Yeah, My Bots. So yeah. I think twitter.com/lightaesthetic/list/mybots.
Something along those lines, yeah.
Anyway, I have like 30 bots.
Yeah, and they are, and one of the local, like, online newspapers wrote about you, didn't they?
Bostino.
Bostino, that's right.
Yeah.
And they wrote about your geographical one.
At Voice of Boston.
Voice of Boston, that's right. So
yeah.
You should check out all of these. I think my favorite is the Mixology bot,
yep.
Which is fun. And I've made a couple of drinks from there and got a little drunk because I don't do cocktails very well.
And Mixology bot's one of my favorites. It
seems
to be a fan favorite. Actually, the new fan favorite, at Color a Day bot. And every day around noon or something, it just tweets a random color and with the image of the color so you can see. And it says, like, the color of the day for, you know, April 25th, 2014 is, you know, dark blue. With Color a Day, every time it tweets the color, I immediately get, like, 10 to 20 email notifications of people who have retweeted or favorited it.
Nice.
Sometimes people... apparently has really rabid fans, because sometimes people will say, like, that is a dumb color for this day. Or, like, this is my birthday, why do I get such a bad color?
All right, well, let's go to the book. Is this the first Atwood that you've read?
Yes. I remember...
oh my gosh.
Sometime in middle school or high school watching the movie.
Okay.
I don't remember anything about it.
Okay, so you haven't seen it since
you seen it since I read it, and I've never read the book.
Okay, well, you should definitely... I say go back and watch the movie, because I know when we were first talking about the book, you had mentioned that you'd seen the movie, and I had never seen the movie. I actually completely forgot that they had made a movie version of it, and I've read this book since high school probably 5 or 6 times. So over the last... God, what is that? Almost 10 years. And that would be Olivia Leaving by Olivia. She's the dog. I have read this 5 or 6 times, and every time I read it, it gets better, I think, personally. And the movie was a different experience for me. Do you remember when it was? Was it the 90s? It was
sometime in the 90s.
Yeah, it was the mid-90s. And
when was the book released?
Excuse me. The book was released in 86.
Yeah.
Originally, it was either 86 or 85. And then the movie was, you know, a few years later. So it might have been the early. It was 85 was the first edition. But the movie was, the way it was filmed, it was very... It didn't age well. It was very, like, you know, a lot of movies that are set in the future, they're set far enough in the future that you can tell, you can't really tell how far in the future it is or where it is. This was very much a future, like, early 90s, late 80s movie. So, like, the technology, the fashion, the dress, and that sort of thing. And I was just like, But, what was really good about it is they mostly stayed true to the book, which I thought was great.
Okay.
But the ending was completely different. And I don't know if you remember the ending of the movie.
I do not.
Yeah, so it was completely different than what happened in the book. And when that happened, I was like, wait, what just happened? So definitely go back and watch
okay.
it. Okay. So what were your, like, your first gut responses to the book?
Well, I really liked... Well, because I'm a huge fan of, you know, sci-fi, speculative fiction, yeah. all that kind of stuff. I thought it was really kind of well done. But my first thought that stood out as I was reading this was I really love the perspective. Mm-hmm. Or I love the style in which it was written was really cool.
Now, did you get... I didn't... As always, I'm going to warn you now. Spoilers. If you don't want to hear them, don't listen.
So we can talk about spoilers now.
Oh, yeah. We talk all the way... we talk about the ending. We're going to in a moment.
Awesome.
So did you know... How early did you realize that she was looking back and that this was something... She was sort of reflecting on her experiences.
I actually wrote a note, because I was reading this on my Kindle. So on the Kindle app, I actually wrote a note at that point where I thought maybe something is different, because the whole book is written in the historical present. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's in first person, but they're telling past events in present tense. So you know that it's stuff that has happened in the past, but you can write it in the historical present without actually reflecting on things.
Yeah,
so,
and the big thing is you're not sure how far.
Right.
You're not sure where each thing relates until the very end.
Page 139, apparently.
Wow.
Because she says, he draws away, looks down at me. There's a smile again, the sheepish one, such candor. Not like that, he says, as if he meant it. And then she switches to past tense and says, he was so sad. And so that was the first point. And then she says, that is a reconstruction, too.
Yeah.
So she's talking about, she's outright saying that what she's saying is reconstructions. So I wasn't sure at that point how to take that. Oh. Having read all the way through, I now realize what she meant by that. But at the time, I wasn't exactly sure. But she says, maybe I should have thought about that at the time, but I didn't. As I said, this is a reconstruction. And then later on, she changes into past tense. Mm-hmm. So breaking that whole historical present thing and actually saying, like, this is... There are two timelines going on, me recollecting and then what's actually happening in the recollection.
Yeah, it's interesting. I honestly could not tell you the first couple of times I read it. The first few times I read it was just for fun. It was one of those books I'd heard about, and it was sort of like, I should read it. Everyone was like, you should read this book. You will love this book. Read this book. But at one point when I read it in the past, I wrote, what kind of narrative is this, on page 53? And I now, looking at it, I'm like, oh, that's kind of a big hint. Like, that's what is this? And then because I was going back and rereading it this time, it was sort of like, you know, I already knew what was happening. I knew how the book ended. I knew about the epilogue and that sort of thing. But it was really interesting, so I wasn't sure when you'd found it. Right. I don't think I would have caught it that early, because it was very... And as I've reread it each time, those sort of, not recommendations or references, but those sort of mentions of the past and the present, it's sort of constant. So, like, she's flashing back within the flashback.
Yep.
And it's just that sort of where every time she talked about her daughter or her husband, both of, all of those, or even Moira a lot, pre-Gilead Moira, every time she talked about those, it was kind of like, wait, what?
Yep.
'Cause it changed just enough where it was a little bit jarring.
Yeah. I mean, that was also kind of another thing that I really liked was how the book is kind of written in the stream of consciousness style.
Much more punctuation, which I appreciate.
Right. Because she seamlessly transitions from what's happening now to what happened in the past and back and forth, and then flashbacks within flashbacks. Another thing that I really liked about this kind of stream of consciousness style is that you can tell that she, like, was an educated woman in the past and really loves words, which is kind of like a reoccurring thing, because she'll say one thought with a word and then immediately say something completely irrelevant but using the same word, like, in a different form.
Yeah, and like, that's... And I think that's why, I think what that just highlights how incredibly brilliant Margaret Atwood is. The word games that she plays, and I loved, while you're looking, I loved that Scrabble was sort of the basis of the Commander and Alfred's relationship.
Like she says, not to mention the exploding atomic power plants along the San Andreas Fault, nobody's fault.
Yeah.
Like things like that, where she just switches the word.
To check out Margaret Atwood's The Blind Assassin.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one that she won the Man Booker Prize for, and it's three books within a book. So there's the book, and then there's the book that someone wrote, and then there's a book that's being written, and it's like it's mind-boggling, but the writing and the playing with words is phenomenal.
I think I would like that, because you know what else is a book within a book within a book?
I'm assuming the Leaf book.
House of Leaves,
House of Leaves. Yeah. This one is, it looks more like this. it's a, you know, a standard novel, and it's got words that appear in order. But it's, and the characters, her quotes, like, they're just the best old lady quotes. You're just kind of like, God, I want to be her when I grow up. Okay, so how did you feel about the, so sort of the premise of the Republic of Gilead?
There were some things that I didn't understand. Like, it seems to me like a lot of stuff seemed to be cleared up as they went along, but it seems to me that the Republic of Gilead, or whatever it was called, didn't seem to me to be, like, a fully fleshed-out world, I guess. Or, like, there were a lot of questions that were kind of left open for me to, like, what actually was going on or what actually happened.
And I think that makes me wonder, like, personally, I really like the epilogue for this book.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that, you know, the book could easily have ended on page whatever it is before the very last page before the epilogue. But in choosing to add the epilogue, I think she sort of saves herself from that.
Yeah.
Because of it
that.
Is. And so at the very end of the epilogue, it talks about how The Handmaid's Tale was found, and it was actually, they were able to place it to the very early beginnings of the Republic of Gilead, and they're sometime well into the future. So I thought that was, it brought it all together and saved
right.
it, whereas, like, you sort of know, because of the story that she's telling, that they're transitioning from what is the modern U.S.,
mm-hmm.
modern then 1980s. I mean, this could still technically happen if you think about it, which I think is... terrifying. And that's why she's so great at this. But, you know, transitioning from the modern U.S. to this super ultra military regulated society. But in choosing to add the epilogue, which is, hold on, what is it? They call it, it's like
the historical notes.
The historical notes on The Handmaid's Tale, and it's set in 2195, and they're discussing Galadian studies, which I think is awesome. Like, I think I was blogging about this when I wrote about the book after I read it again, that I felt that the book would have been fine on its own, but in choosing to do that, she tied it all together.
Right.
But I guess sort of what did you think about the warnings that she was giving, the fanatic conservatism, that sort of thing? Because this is considered one of the, not early feminist texts, but the, it's a big feminist text.
Mm-hmm.
The division of the gender roles, and sort of they take it from, you know, oh, these women are getting too smart, they don't want to have babies, and then she takes it to the extreme of, you know, there was some sort of chemical fallout, and the men aren't able to produce, and a lot of the women aren't able to produce. So, like, she's actually picking things that are currently and or could happen immediately. Mm-hmm. How did that, like, make you feel, or, like,
I mean,
as you were reading it?
I thought it was kind of terrifying, especially because the way that she sets it off, that you don't really know, you don't really know what actually is going on or behind the scenes or whatever, because what happens is, you know, she's at work and suddenly her boss says, you're all laid off, you'll have to go. There's so much left out of kind of that transition. I'm not sure what happened, but it all seems plausible because of the world afterwards of Gilead does not seem plausible, or rather, I'm not sure how we can get from one to the other so quickly or something.
Yeah.
But kind of like the way she describes the start of it was kind of really terrifying.
Yeah, and it's because you don't learn, you learn it in bits and pieces, mm-hmm. which I thought was, it was brilliant in doing it that way. So you didn't like, here's the backstory, you know, in the prologue there wasn't like a, the United States has fallen, the Republic of Gilead mm-hmm. has taken its place. You're like slowly, and I think that transition helps with the chaos, mm-hmm. but sort of the idea of the entire U.S. government being destroyed in one go, it was like, it's still pertinent, like yep. 30 years later, all this shit can happen. It's interesting, because did you see, have you read The Hunger Games in those books?
Yes.
Do you see any parallels?
Yes.
Yeah. It's, I'm like, oh, Susan Collins, like, I like you, and I enjoyed reading those books, but you ripped off Margaret Atwood.
She ripped off a lot of things.
Oh, she definitely did. But this, I'm just going to keep recommending more and more books for you. Another series by Margaret Atwood that you need to read, and you actually,
series.
I think, there's three books.
Okay.
And I think you'll appreciate it more because it's more sciencey, is the Oryx and Crake trilogy. So it's Oryx and Crake, Year of the Flood, and Mad Atom. Mad Atom is the one that just came out last year. It was the end of the trilogy, but the first two are really, really good. And it's the same idea. I wouldn't say post-apocalyptic, but it's a post society. It's uh-huh. dystopia. It's all everything. So, like, rather than the religion and the women's rights and the reproduction, that's like science and pills and genetic body modification,
oh, yeah.
and genetic modification and that sort of thing.
Like BioShock.
Yeah, it's actually, you could see BioShock could easily be set in this, huh. and it's phenomenal. Definitely check them out. The first one, I think, is the strongest, and then the second, and then the third, which is kind of weird, because it's usually like the first and third are really good, and the second one's kind of, eh. Yes, you should definitely check those out, because they're good. I love Margaret Atwood. I need to read all of them. I've got a couple over there that I've not read of her older works. But anyway, so back to the story.
Cool.
One of the things that I found interesting, and I've actually I wrote a paper on it, was the patronyms of their names.
Yep.
So, like, all of the women, the handmaids, so the characters are divided into three, I guess,
casts.
three paths, four types of women, basically. You've got the wives, the Marthas, the handmaids, and then you've got the Econo wives, which I think are even more fascinating. But they're all divided by color. Green for the Marthas, blue for the wives, and the red for the handmaids. And the Econo wives are cool because they're striped. And
yep.
I was like, yay, stripes! Multi-roles. So what did you think about that, like, dividing up the women's roles?
I mean, it seemed to make sense, I guess. Like, a lot of... seems to be a recurring thing with, like, dividing people into castes and then color-coding them. Mm-hmm. Like, that happens in Brave New World.
Yep.
Yeah.
And there are definitely bits you can see of yeah. Brave New World in here.
So I kind of just took it at face value as just a sci-fi trope.
See, I found it... I guess I have a degree in gender studies.
Oh.
So I wrote one of my master's papers on that. There's another one, Woman on the Edge of Time. Have you ever read that? It's Marge Piercy.
Hmm.
I feel like I'm showing off for you. Yeah, that one's really interesting because it was an early feminist Latina text. It mm-hmm. was written in the 70s, so it's before this, and it's a utopic society. But one of the things that I was writing about is how you have to have the dystopia to have the utopia, you have to have the utopia to have the dystopia, mm-hmm. and whether it's an actual utopia, or is it just anything's better than what's going on? So, like, in this one, it's like, well, before it wasn't really utopia, but when they're looking back on it, they kind of make it look prettier
mm-hmm.
because it's the idealized version of what they knew. That one is really interesting because it's like a mental institution, and she's in there, but is she in there? Is she not in there?
Yeah.
And then it does the same type of thing with the epilogue. You get to see her medical papers at the end, mm-hmm. so you're like, what? Did that actually happen? Did it not happen? This one, I think, is really, really interesting because there was one quote. I wait, I compose myself. Myself is the thing I must now compose as one composes a speech. What I must present is a made thing, not something born.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really, really interesting because one of the key things that you learn when you take, like, an introductory to gender theory or an introductory to, like, sexuality studies classes about how gender and sexuality and all of those are things you're constantly performing.
Right.
And I felt that in her – and she wrote this book before that was sort of fleshed out
mm-hmm.
in the gender theory world and the feminist studies. I mean, they were happening at about the same time when she wrote this book. And I thought it was really interesting because she takes, like – the three things that women, quote unquote, traditionally are supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
the homemaker, the wife, and the baby maker, and she divides them into very distinct categories.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like, and then we're not, and we don't have, you know, we don't have the Martha's tale, we don't have the wife's tale, mm-hmm. but we don't have their story. But sort of, so we have this one portion of it, and she reduces it down. So this is all going back to the patronym, which I feel like I've been harping on for 10 minutes about this, of the fact that they lose all of their identity. So we never actually learn her name in the book. In the movie, they give her a name. But I thought that was really interesting because she strips them down to that very, very basic function. And it's just kind of like, what? Why?
I was kind of game designer background. I was thinking of that. I was trying to like think of the systems, the systems at play. You have, you know, the gender role stripped into the three component parts, but when you look at what's actually going on with those women, this is also part of the world building. Like, I'm not entirely sure, like, what kind of led up to that. It's presumed that the wives are barren, which is why they need handmaids.
Yeah.
But I'm not entirely sure, like, what separates Martha's from handmaids in that way.
Yeah.
Like, where... Because one thing that also confused me is when children are finally born in this society, what happens to them? Like, are they, do they grow up in that house? And then at what age do they then, like, turn into a wife or a Martha or something else? Or...
That was interesting, because they sort of explained that as in passing. And the only reason I know it is because I've read this book so many times. But you're right, because I'm not sure where the Marthas came from. I know where the aunts come from. So they're sort of the military branch of the women, the women's military, quote-unquote, branch. They're not allowed to have guns and that sort of thing. But those, there's a comment, offhand comment in the book, and it's just kind of like those are the older women, older bitter women who didn't want to go to the colonies.
Yeah.
But the Marthas, I'm not sure about. That's really interesting. I'm wondering if they were just other older women that weren't like mean enough or cool enough to be aunts.
Because I kind of think it's a, like, it would be a really elegant system from a systems perspective.
Yeah.
If the wives, for example, they are barren, they can't have children, and also they are, you know, too elite, I guess, to be doing housework. Like, they have servants. Which is what separates them from the other two. And the handmaids, if, for example, they are have proven themselves to be fertile, but then arbitrarily they're not wives or they're not Marthas. And then the Marthas, I'm not exactly sure like how that fits in, how they fit in either, but it would, I was kind of thinking like it would be a much more elegant system if that kind of trio was kind of more fleshed out.
Yeah, and I think that's why her setting it in the early time period gives her that little bit of leeway. But the children that are born, she mentions it at the ceremony of desecution, which is an awesome word she made up. Those girls that are getting married to the soldiers, they say that so any child is born will then be automatically given to a man at some point. Like, you know, they'll grow up and they'll turn into a wife. And if they're a higher, if Alfred had had a daughter at some point, Serena would have then, you know, they would have to have given the daughter away at some point later.
As a wife or a kind of wife?
Yeah, it would have been a wife, I think. And I assume that would be based on their status again.
Right.
So, like, Serena up at the top with the commander, you know, her daughter would go to, like, another, not a commander, but a, I don't know, a lieutenant or something. Whereas, like, an Akano wife, if they had a daughter, that probably more than likely become another Akano wife, sort of like they not only is it just
there's no rags to riches stories in this.
Yeah, I would say not only is it just striated between Martha's wives and handmaids, you've got the classes as well, and it's, and this is a very white society. It's gonna say a lot about me, but and I think it has to do with the way it was written, but I assumed the Marthas were black.
I assumed they were Hispanic because of the name Rita.
Oh, that makes even more sense. But I think, I guess the reason I did it is because I read, at one point when I read this, I read The Help Right Then, too. And that was about the African-American help.
Oh.
And I just sort of assumed, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But then in the movie, it was two old white ladies.
Okay.
I was like, I have no idea where these two came from, but okay. Because they actually just seemed way too old to be doing that sort of housework. But then the better question is, where are all of the minorities?
Right.
Because you don't, there's very little mention of any
of
sort of, yeah, it's just, it's completely whitewashed. Because you do know that Serena's white, and the commander, and Upfred. There may have been one mention in passing. In the movie, they definitely show like a truckload of minorities. A couple of them, actually. And then there's, like, race riots, and I'm like, making me a little uncomfortable. What's going on? There's not a single minority woman in the Handmaid Center, the Red Center, so I thought that was interesting. Miss Atwood has some explaining to do.
Because one of the things that they do is they have the handmaids, you know, might... They pay someone else to...
Oh, that's right. They might use another man, like a doctor or a chauffeur or something.
And I was thinking, like... If they do have a baby, you would be able to tell that the baby wasn't, you know, the commander's or whatever. I'm assuming the idea is that the baby of the handmaid is supposed to be the commander's, mm-hmm. or it's supposed to be thought of as the baby of the commander and his wife.
Yes.
So I guess maybe they don't want, you know, any mixed race
children. It's miscegenation.
Yeah.
Oh, what? I mean, this was the 80s, yeah. but Atwood's Canadian. She's pretty damn liberal. Huh. So this is going to test your knowledge of the movie, because I told you, I wasn't a big, big fan of the movie, because not only did they change the ending, but in the book, she doesn't kill the commander. She just gets taken away. And they're just kind of like, what happened? Who called uh-huh. these people the angels? In the movie, she kills the commander. She slits his throat.
Aww.
And then she gets taken away.
And then
again,
she escapes?
She's rescued. Well, no, she's rescued. Oh. But it's like super drawn out. And it's like, oh, I love you, Nick. Why? I love you so much. But what I didn't like about the movie is that they made Serena, they made it a little bit too much about her. They made her too sympathetic.
Too
sympathetic?
The handmaid?
No, just to us, to the viewers. Oh. So, like, whereas in this, there was a little bit of sympathy you got for Serena from Alfred's story, a gospel singer on TV, and, like, oh, how she's fallen. So, like, there's that little tiny bit in here yeah. where, like, where Alfred starts to sort of, like, feel sorry for her.
Uh-huh.
But in the movie, they, like, laid it on thick. And I was like, no. This is not her story. This is Natasha Richards' story. Don't do that. So that was one. I think that was probably the biggest problem I had with the movie. Was
okay.
that it was sort of. It wasn't. They sort of tried to have the two women story and like,
yeah.
oh, we're gonna be bonded with sisterhood.
Mm.
It was just not. Changing that part was the one like crucial thing that I thought they just took a little too far.
Yeah.
Like they could have done it with a couple of scenes, but then it was just kind of like the one scene is after the ceremony. So after the commander tries to get the handmaid pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Serena is like, she's like, get out of bed. Leave. And so she kicks her out as soon as the ceremony is done. And then they just like pan out and show the wife crying on the bed. And I was like, no, that is not okay. Go show Alfred crying in her room.
Yeah.
I don't want to see Serena crying. That portion of it that they changed is like, oh, I don't know about this. The movie was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else that sort of stood out in the book for you?
Actually, I do want to talk about the epilogue.
Yes.
Because what happened was, so I'm reading the book on my iPad, and I will show you what happens, but, and it just says historical notes, and I assume the book is over, because I'm reading the last thing, and I'm like, yeah, that makes sense, that's an ending. And then I flip the page, and it pops up, before you go.
It jumps the before you go,
yeah.
and the rate here, the book, here's some more. Oh,
yep.
Whoa.
So it did that, and so at first, I thought that was the end of the book, and so I just closed the iPad.
Oh,
and then I came back to read, like, to review some other parts of the book, and that's when I realized, oh, there is more. I was going to read the historical notes on The Handmaid's Tale. I thought it was, like, a, you know, a history of the novel or something.
Yeah, like
saying that this is, like, an after-the-fact
publication. How it's reception.
And the first paragraph says, 12th Symposium on Gileadian Studies, June 25th, 2195. And I was like, oh, that's different.
You were like, oh, I should probably read this and see about the
yeah.
end of the novel.
And so then I read that, and I was like, oh, this is actually really cool, and it kind of ties up a lot of things that questions I had,
yeah.
and it kind of actually makes this even more sci-fi.
Yep.
I thought it was a much more brilliant ending than just the previous ending that I read, where I was kind of like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, and it's all you find out is that it in... So the angels come and get Alfred... And you're like, oh, so she's gonna die. But then we find out,
yeah.
Nick tells her, no, they're of the Resistance. Mayday is what it was called, which was kind of corny, but it was kind of cool. And they rescue her. And, like, so it could have ended right there. But then, like, we've already said a couple of times, you flash forward, we don't know how many years. And they're having, one, I just love the names. So the names are Marianne Crescent Moon, James Darcy Piotto. No idea how to pronounce
that. Piotto, that's what I would say.
Yeah, Piotto. Johnny Running Dog. They're very much sort of make you think back to the Native American names and that sort of thing. So it's like,
well, they are in none of it.
Huh?
They are in none of it.
Yeah, I was going to say. And then that's just like, they've complete. These are the people that survived living in the woods. And it does. So it was really interesting because, like you said, it took the speculative fiction part of it, tied it all up very, very well, mm-hmm. and then actually put it into the future. So, like, everything aside from that, you could be like, oh, well, this could have been in the past. And you're like, I don't really know what's going on.
My favorite part was they're talking about the other professors who have worked on this stuff, and they say, Professor Sieglinde Van Buren from the Department of Military History at the University of San Antonio, Republic of Texas. And I was like, I am really happy that further in the future, Texas goes back to being a republic.
Texas gets its own republic. And it's interesting because they, in both the film and the book, they talk about the strongholds, like where parts of the U.S. mm-hmm. are being held out. And so clearly, we have to assume that Texas was one of the ones where they just couldn't, I mean, you know, crazy conservatives in the South, and what's going on down there? Because the other one they mentioned was Appalachia. So it's really interesting that they did that. But I thought, for some reason, for me, even though it does sort of, but what's interesting, for me, it made the story more real. Mm-hmm. So it made Ufred's story more real, having this added on to it. And I know that part of that is because I've got a really good suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
But part of it is they actually studied this story because it was historically accurate, even though they questioned, like, the authenticity of it.
Like, the whole... One of the things that I really like is how there's, like, that unreliable narrator where even she mentions, like, this is a reproduction. There's the story with Nick where she's like, that's how I wanted it to happen. That's not how it happened. And she tells another story. She's like, that's not how it happened either. It's like, this is what really happened. Or even when talking about Mora, I'm going to try and reproduce what happened while keeping her spirit in this or something.
Oh, that's right, because she's like, I'm going to reproduce her exact quote. This is the speech she gave me or something like that. It is a diary. If we find out that it was a voice recording on cassette tapes, which they're like, oh, they're so ancient. And it's like, oh, God, they actually are. 30 years later. Oh, wait. Something I did. Boston. You realize this was set in Boston.
I didn't realize. Well, because I was trying to figure out where this might have taken place, and it's literally not until maybe halfway through the book that they finally mention Harvard Yard.
Never knew it was in Boston until I read it this time.
And then I was like, wow, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, and you know, it was the sentence, what confirmed it for me mm-hmm. was when she says her mom moved across the river.
Yeah.
And I was like, it is in Cambridge is where she is. And I was like, holy, what? For some reason, it made it that much more interesting when I read it this time.
I think for me, it was because they kept talking about a university.
Yep.
And there was one point where they mentioned Memorial Hall in Harvard.
See, and every university I've ever been to or seen has a Memorial Hall. So I was just like, oh, that's a generic.
Yeah, well, because they mentioned, like, it looks like a church, and that's where the undergraduates would eat. And
as soon as I read that this time, I was like, oh, I know exactly which building that is.
Yeah.
It was fascinating.
And then she was talking about escaping or something, and like when she hit Mass Ave.
Yeah, I guess because I haven't read it since I've lived uh-huh. up here. And I just, when I realized that, I was like, wait, what? This is Boston. This is so much cooler.
To think that all of this happened up here.
This could be our past or our future. It is our future. God, I hope not.
Cautionary tale.
It is, and I think that's what she is really great about. If she comes back for another book, you should go see her, because someone invariably always asks, and they did at Mad Adam, mm-hmm. They ask why she chooses to do things that are so close to the real that they could happen, and she's like, it's because I'm afraid for the future. I am terrified of what these people are doing to our country. And like, one of the things she does on Twitter is she forwards a lot of like activist things out there. She's like, oh, check out this thing. It's from that trilogy, mm-hmm. the Orcs and Craig trilogy. One of the storylines is about all the bees dying off, and like she's actually found, she'll find like some obscure fact or something interesting, and then she'll write an entire book based off of this one little fact. And it's this world that's just right next, it's like, it could be 10 years in the future, or, you know, maybe 20 years. And, like, this one is even closer now because we're even further down the rabbit hole of what she was talking about leading into the Republic of Gilead versus, like, Oryx and Craig. Some of the technology she's writing about, we're not quite there, but, like, it's just around the corner. And then that could be just around the next corner. So it's really terrifying. I think she's a master at speculative fiction. And this is one of her early novels. So just imagine. So between this one, 1986, and Oryx and Craig, which was, I think, was like 2000, and then the next one was 2004, and then the last one was like 8 years. So 15 years, probably 10 or 15 books in between. So just imagine how much better her writing is. And all of your questions are answered, I feel. Maybe not in that first book, but by the end of the trilogy, you're like, what? what just happened. I'm afraid.
Oh, about speculative fiction thing. I kind of find it really interesting just to read, like, what authors perceive the future to be. Usually juxtapose with how they perceive the present. There's one line in the epilogue where it's like, things that you read in speculative fiction that make you think, oh, this was written, you know, back in the 80s or whatever. Mm-hmm. Kind of, like, breaks the immersion, I guess.
Oh, that's very true. It's like the flying cars and...
Yeah, in the epilogue where they say that it was, the diary was voice recorded on these cassettes, and they explain like what cassettes are and all of that, and then they say approximately 30 tape cassettes of the type that became obsolete sometime in the 80s or 90s with the advent of the compact disc. Number one, this is in 2195. It's kind of ambiguous to say that they got obsolete in the 80s or 90s because they're talking about the wrong century, but also that they mention the advent of the compact disc. Because it is 2014 and compact discs are already obsolete.
Yeah.
With, you know, digital downloads and all of that. So it seems like if I were in 2195, I would say, just say, you know, they were obsolete.
Yeah.
Not naming the next technology, because yeah, by then that's already obsolete too.
But that's interesting that in the 80s she was already like, yeah, they're going. They're yeah. Done. No mention of records, which are making a comeback.
Right.
But yeah, that's really interesting. The names she listed, I thought, placed it very well. So, like, the names of the artists.
Mm-hmm.
They placed
yeah.
it perfectly. So, it's like, you could even more be like, oh, so yeah, this was definitely supposed to happen in the 80s. But then it's sort of like, but what happened?
Right.
Like, I still don't really know. Did Gilead fall? I don't think they mentioned it in the epilogue. Because I feel like it's sort of talked about in the past tense.
Yeah, that's what I assumed. I assumed it had fallen at some point because there wouldn't be any anthropological studies of Gilead unless it had already fallen.
Oh, anthropologies. Anthropologists study everything. That's why it's great. There's no actual...
Well, they seem to be talking about it as if it's already...
Yeah, and I think that's sort of what I assumed as well, because it all seemed like back-looking.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just because they were talking about the pre... the early... Republic of Gilead period, because they were like, oh, this, we've dated it to here, but they sort of talked about like the pre and the late as well, so I think I did assume, but I didn't want to like make that for sure, like, oh yeah, no, it definitely fell, yeah, this is a post, but then again, it also takes place in the Republic of Texas, so it could still be out there, and this was just stuff that was smuggled out. So do you have any parting thoughts on the book?
Now I'm going to like try and come up with like a good nugget of knowledge.
Read it. It's awesome. Everybody should read it. And I think, actually, I won't loan you my copy because it's another signed copy, but I'll let you read the blurb on Woman on the Edge of Time, and you should definitely check out. Just because I think it's a really interesting juxtaposition to this, because it's almost the exact opposite. Marge Piercy creates this utopia world where all relationships are three people. When the three people raise a baby, men can breastfeed, babies aren't actually born, they're incubated like in a giant womb, no one actually has to carry the baby to term. Like, it's really interesting compared to this, the stark exact opposite. Uh-huh. And like, instead of highly militarized, sectioned society, oh, we're gonna live in this rainforest beautiful area. And the juxtaposition, I think a 25 or 30 page paper on these two books comparing the binaries and that sort of thing. So it's really interesting.
Cool.
Any last thoughts? I've got some questions, so you can still think about them.
I have a final question, I guess. Do they mention how far The Handmaid's Tale takes place, how far that is from when it all started?
So it's like, it's definitely within the first 4 or 5 years, I think. So like, it's super early, and I think that's one of the reasons, it's like you were saying, it's one of the reasons that saves Atwood for not having to explain. I think it would be a completely different novel if this were 30 years in.
Right.
Or even 10 years in.
Well, because they explain how, like, the younger girls eventually would have been phased out, so all they know is this society.
This society, yeah. But it works because... And then you also still have the strong resistance movement.
Right.
And another, I guess another reason I think it's picked that 1980 arbitrary date, it's 84, 85 if we're right there. But there's still enough people in the underground involved. So, like, the Quakers and that sort of thing that haven't been routed up. And they're still finding nuns and priests. If it were any later, I feel like most of those people would have been eradicated at that point or sent out. I would say no more than 5 would be about where I would assume her tale starts.
Right. Yeah.
But it's definitely early on, and it definitely helps Atwood avoid some answers.
Right.
but it's still, I mean, it's one of her best novels that I've read. I've not read a bad novel by her, and I recommend all of them. Okay. You would, The Blind Assassin, I think, is great. It's probably the most convoluted of her books. As we close out, I have a series of standard questions I like to ask all of my guests. I now have to think of new questions for people that come back. And if anyone hears this, they get to prepare their answers. So when I start releasing it, I might have to change
it. Oh, that's not fair.
One, I know the answer to, because I just saw your Kindle. Do you own a library card?
I own an e-card.
Okay.
Not a physical one yet.
Boston?
Yes.
Did you know that Boston recently started their streaming service?
That's why I got the e-card.
Yes. That's why I need to renew mine. Have you checked out, like, is it a really wide variety? Have you?
I haven't checked it out yet.
I know it's something I want to do, but yeah. I'm just like, oh, I've got so much other stuff I want to do.
Well, because I think one of the things is that you think there's a limit. Like, if you want to download episodes or something to watch of something or a movie, you can only do, like, 10 per month.
I'm not surprised with that. If you've ever, with your Kindle, if you've checked out books from the library, they've only got X number that they can give out at a time, so you can check out the digital ones.
Yeah.
It's all digital rights management that I don't really understand. Going on that, when was your first library card?
My first library card was in elementary school. My elementary school actually had, like, a program. Well, number one, because my aunt was a substitute teacher at the local elementary school. And so my sister and I would stay with my cousins and my aunt all the time in order for her to, like, entertain us during the summer or whenever when we would all stay with her. Yeah. We would all go to the library. We would all, like, pick out a book and then read it and then go back. And then eventually in, like, first grade or something, the school actually had this program where, you know, you read a book, you answer a little quiz and get points, and then you can trade in the points for stuff.
Reader?
Yes.
Yes, I loved that. Okay.
Well, there was something before that, and then I think
there was, but I can't remember what it was called.
And then eventually we did Accelerated Reader. I remember reading Harry Potter with Accelerated Reader, and the Harry Potter books were worth so many points.
Oh. This one I already know the answer to, but do you own a digital reading device?
I own several.
Several?
Well, because I have my iPad Mini, which I've been using the Kindle app, which I've been reading more lately on, but I actually do have an actual Kindle. So I do read on that sometimes. I just find it easier to be on my iPad because I use my iPad so much
for
more.
Everything else, yeah. But I actually miss assuming this is the one you have.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine died. So it's just sitting here. But I got a new Paperwhite recently, which is... I actually really like the Paperwhite. I was afraid with the touch. A lot of the books I read have footnotes. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid... I read War and Peace. Mm-hmm. I read that on the iPad, and every time I went to hit... one of the footnotes, it turned the page. It's like, oh, this is going to drive me batshit crazy. And that is a long book to do that. So I tested. Luckily, Matt had a Paperwhite, and I was able to test footnotes on his, and it just worked perfectly. I was like, all right, I can get a Paperwhite now that thing's broken. But I like it. I like the Paperwhite. Yeah. What do you do? Do you do audiobooks? That's
another. Sometimes. Mostly because when I was driving to work, carpooling to work, we would listen to podcasts and audiobooks. Normally, I prefer to read.
Yeah.
There were some exceptions. Tina Fey's book, Bossy Pants.
You're the second person to mention that one.
It's narrated by Tina Fey, and it is hilarious and awesome.
Have you read One More Thing? He narrates it as well, so that might be one you want to...
Pretty much any book narrated by a comedian will be awesome.
Yeah, and I think he's got other famous people to read.
There was one, though, Ready Player 2? I forgot who wrote it, but the audiobook was narrated by Will Wheaton. And I normally like Will Wheaton. But something about his voice, no offense to Will Wheaton, just narrating a book for, you know, however many hours we did in that car ride, I kind of hated the book. But also...
You were done with it.
But also I kind of had a problem with the book itself, because the book is supposed to be about, like, the whole world is kind of hooked into this, like, Second Life type game. The guy who made the game hid, you know, some his vast fortune somewhere in the game. Okay. And so the main character and his friends, like, try and go on this adventure to try and find, like, the hidden treasure inside the game. But the way that the book is written pretty much as an homage to the 80s. Like, the main character gets obsessed with 80s culture.
Okay. Is it a riff on Ready Player One?
That's it.
Okay.
That is Ready Player One.
I was sort of wondering if this was, like, a sarcastic version, retelling of the same book.
No, okay, Ready Player One. That's what it's called.
I've not read it, but I was like, this sounds a lot like that one, but okay.
But no, because the way that it's written, the main character will just go on a diatribe. Nostalgia, remember that? Here's a bunch of stuff that happened, and just go on for on and on, and it seemed like so self-aggrandizing or whatever.
What is the last book that you read?
Hold on. I'm going to open up my iPad.
See, you were smart. Everyone else I've asked that to is like, oh, I don't know what I've been lugging around for the last couple of weeks.
Oh, The Disaster Artist.
Oh, okay. That's right. And we were talking about that. That's the one
on
The Room.
Greg Sestero's time working on The Room with Tommy Wiseau. And it is fantastic and hilarious and amazing. My friend Zoe Quinn, who, if you follow indie games at all...
I know. I'm such a casual gamer. gamer. She, I'm a poser.
You filthy casual.
I'm a poser.
Depression Quest is okay. The one she's most well known for. She made a comment a while ago about how a lot of people are talking about, you know, nostalgia games, mm-hmm. you know, making games, you know, that are 8-bit, lo-fi graphics, whatever, to, you know, be nostalgic.
My favorite game from indie. the indie booths at PAX. It's called Pixel.
But Zoe was saying how all these games are, you know, based on nostalgia, but her nostalgia was not, you know, 8-bit platform. She grew up playing full motion video FMV games.
I don't know what those are.
So like Phantasmagoria or Myst or I forget the other big ones where it's like you'll be playing a game and then there's actual video of people in the game, and that was like what she grew up with, and so she's actually working on an FMV game to be her own nostalgia homage whatever game. And she has already signed on Greg Sestero.
Oh wow.
To act in it, and Ashley Birch. Nice. So I am very excited to see what comes of this game because it sounds amazing.
Yeah, that's really it's so many like tangential connections, which is so cool. So that's what you last or are currently reading. Do you have a favorite genre or a favorite book aside from House of Leaves?
Aside from House of Leaves?
Or is that like just it? Well, and that's totally legit, but we already talked about it.
I really do love House of Leaves.
Okay.
I really love horror and I love sci-fi. My favorite book, I'm going to say what my favorite book is, with the caveat that, well, because every time I say, people always judge me for having this as my favorite book, but I'll just say it's Anthem.
Okay.
By Ayn Rand.
Okay.
Yeah,
you told me I should read that.
Yeah, I do not, this is not an endorsement of Ayn Rand's ideologies, but I just really love the story. It is her least preachy of her books.
Okay. I've never read anything.
And it's
her.
it's also very short. You can read it in an hour.
It's on my Kindle. I just have never gotten around to it.
And I just really like the story. I think it's really cool. Rush, the band Rush, did a song called 2112 that is loosely based on the plot of Anthem. I really love Rush and I really love Prague, and I really love that this is a song that exists. Because in Anthem, you know, it's a dystopian society. People, you know, are separated into their own jobs. Mm-hmm. This one guy has decided that he doesn't actually want to do his job and wants to, like, be a scientist. And so at one point he sneaks off and then gets into, like, a little cave or something and finds a light bulb and discovers electricity. And he tries to show it to the elders, who are then like, well, then we can't have this because what'll happen to the candle makers? And, you know, it'll set off the whole unbalance of everything, and we hate you. In 2112, instead of electricity, the protagonist finds a guitar and invents music. It's like a rock opera type thing in 7 parts.
Nice. And then I guess if you could, this is the one that everyone's like, ah, why'd you ask that? If you could make me read a book, what would that be?
I really want you to read House of Leaves.
Well, I'm sure I'll try it at some point. It's funny, it's everyone's... I've pretty much counteracted to everyone who said anything so far. Katrin was like, oh, you should read One More Thing by BJ Novak. But then she's also like, oh, you should read this. And I was like, oh, no, I read all sorts of those. and Caroline, same thing. She's like, you should read an erotica novel. I'm like, Caroline, ooh. I have read those. Oh. I blog about them periodically. They make me uncomfortable. And that's why they are really weird blog posts.
Oh, I know what you should read.
Okay.
You should read My Immortal by Tara Gillespie. It is Harry Potter and My Chemical Romance.
This is fan fiction.
It is fan fiction.
All right.
It's so good. It is the worst fan fiction you will ever read, which therefore makes it the best fan fiction you will ever read.
I don't know. I've read some pretty bad fan fiction. I'm obsessed.
This is the seminal work of bad fan fiction. This is one of those fan fictions where I do actually have a hard copy of it.
That's awesome.
And it is amazing and horribly misspelled. And I even wrote a bot about this fan fiction because it's so awesome.
I think that's my biggest problem with self-publishing, is so many of them don't shell out for the editors. And it's I would be fine if the story were a problem. But
this is part of its charm, though. Part of its charm, because every other word is misspelled. It's actually part of the story. So in the beginning, it was written like on her blog or whatever, and she wrote it in chapters. And in the beginning of each chapter, there's an author's note. And in the beginning of the author's note, she says "fangs" to her friend, which is "fangs, thanks," because she's gothic. But thanks for helping her with the spelling and grammar and whatnot. And it's, you know, somewhat well written. You know, there's still misspellings. And then at some point, because she's a Mary Sue, she puts herself as the main character, and her friend is also in there. And so, some point in the story, her friend has they have a falling out, and so she kills off the character in the fan fiction. And then from then on, all of her spelling is so much worse.
Oh no. All right. That is everything. You should definitely check me out on Twitter at Jeff_Whaley. Definitely check out Patrick at Light Aesthetic. And the bots are so cool. I mean, I also like, what's your health one? The Hypochondriac.
The Hypochondriac.
The Hypochondriac is my favorite, I think. Like, I love all of the other ones, but every time that one comes up, I'm like, ooh, I have that too. I should go check that.
Pulled from WebMD.
Yes, pulled from WebMD. But the mixology bot's great, the color one. All right, well, that was it. Say bye.
Bye. Thanks for having me.